Life is poker, not chess, says Annie Duke. She's a former professional poker player who won over $4 million in major tournaments before retiring. Her new book is called Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts, and it draws on her experience at the poker table while also synthesizing all sorts of leading-edge research from social psychology, evolutionary economics, and game theory. Reason sat down with her recently at our New York studios.
Let's think about the difference between a game of poker and a game of chess. So a game of chess, you can see all the pieces, right? So I know your whole position, and there's very little luck involved. The quality of the outcome that you have from playing chess is very, very tightly tied to the quality of the decision-making in the chess game. In other words, I know that if you generally are making worse decisions than I am as we play, that you will lose and I will win.
Life is more like poker because we don't have the facts, we don't have perfect knowledge, we don't even know what the, you know, what other people are holding.
Correct. And this is the really important thing. Outcomes and decision quality in poker are very sort of pulled apart. They're very loosely tied together.
Well, this is probably a good moment to bring up the Pete Carroll example, right?
Sure.
So he's the coach of the Seattle Seahawks in the Super Bowl. He called a play that worked out poorly. The Seahawks lost, and everybody was like, what an idiot. But you actually defend him in that.
I think that this is a really good example of this thing that makes poker a better model for decision-making in general. So in poker, I can have the best hand and I can lose. I can have the worst hand and I can win, just because of the luck of the draw. So we can think about that in terms of this Pete Carroll situation. And we can compare it to this really interesting play that happened in the Super Bowl just now with the Eagles and the Patriots also, because the Patriots are always in the Super Bowl.
That's right. thankfully, they lost this time.
Yes. Well, I'm from Philadelphia, okay. So yes, indeed, yeah. Thankfully. 26 seconds left in the game. The Seattle Seahawks are on the one-yard line of the New England Patriots. They only have one timeout left. It's second down. Everybody is expecting a handoff to Marshawn Lynch, one of the greatest running backs of all time. Boom, plow it through. If he doesn't, they'll call the timeout, hand it off to him again, plow it through. Instead, what Pete Carroll does is he calls for a pass play. Russell Wilson passes the ball, and notoriously, we all know, it was intercepted by Malcolm Butler. End of the game. So obviously, the headlines were not kind to Pete Carroll. But let's do the thought experiment, right? So let's imagine that he calls that play and the pass is caught. Then what do the headlines look like? Brilliant. He outsmarted Belichick. In fact, because of the Super Bowl that just happened, we don't need to do that thought experiment anymore because we have the Philadelphia Eagles on the one-yard line. It's fourth and one. Everybody's expecting them to go for a field goal. Instead, they decide to go for it. They do this crazy thing where Nick Foles steps out of the quarterback position. He runs into the end zone. He catches the ball. And it's, oh my gosh, outsmarted Belichick. But either of those two plays are not brilliant based just on whether they worked out on that one time. That would be like saying if I flip a coin and you call it heads and it lands heads, that you're brilliant, right? So the issue here is what you really want to do is dig down into the math of whether that play was actually correct.
Right. And you point out that it was a smart decision, but the results were not good.
The interception rate in that spot was only about 1 or 2%. So it's this time management, the clock management problem. So if they hand it off to Marshawn Lynch, they're only going to get two tries at the end zone, assuming the first one doesn't work. If they pass it, if it's caught, they win. If it's dropped, the clock stops and they don't use one of their timeouts, and they'll actually still have enough time on the clock to run the exact same two. So people in finance will really understand this. It's almost a free option.
Do you think Pete Carroll, and I realize you're not a psychologist, but do you think he's like, no, that was absolutely, it was the right decision?
So I don't need to be a psychologist to know because he said so. So he was on the Today Show.
The experts, not just average Joe, say it was the worst call ever. It was the worst result of a call ever. The call would have been a great one if we catch it. It would have been just fine and nobody would have thought twice about it.
So Pete Carroll really got that this was a resulting problem. And I think that what's interesting is that now we're seeing the headlines on this, you know, Foles play.
Right.
It's not for nothing, right? Like, right. I mean, this is something we can just sort of look at and say, haha, right. Look at that. Two totally different reactions. Except that we go around and we change our decision making because we've evaluated the quality of decision based on one outcome.
Right.
So as people look at, you know, should you pass in that spot, because it didn't work out in 2015, you know, people are going to change their decision behavior because of that result, so, or maybe they're going to, you know, now go for it more because of this.
Well, and that, you know, in a real life situation, because say it's you're getting married or you're investing or you're buying this house versus the other, these are events that you're not, hopefully not going to do more than, you know, say a dozen times, right, in a lifetime. Like, you don't have that big a data set, right? So
right.
How do you adapt, you know, not being too swayed by the results from the quality of the decision making?
So this is actually one of the really big problems, is that for most of the kinds of decisions that we make in life, we have this hidden information problem, right? There's this big element of luck issue. And in general, most of the decisions that we have, we can't collect enough outcomes for the data to be super meaningful. So I think the way that I put it in the book is we're generally dealing with like 4 coin flips, not 10,000. So what are you supposed to do in that situation? And what I argue is that analyze the decision quality based on these kinds of, sort of the same way that you would analyze the Pete Carroll decision. And try to cordon yourself off from the outcome. In other words, be a really big information gatherer and get as much information so that your beliefs are as well informed as possible. That's number one to being a really good decision maker and solving for this problem, right? Make sure that you are entertaining views that disagree with you in order to calibrate those decisions really well. Those are the most valuable views.
Yeah.
And the last thing is, as you're trying to think about the future, be a really good scenario planner. Get a really good lay of the landscape. Recognize the uncertainty in the future. Don't say, I know it will work out this way, because that will close your mind off to all the other possible ways that it could work out. And once you've figured out, well, here are the sort of set of ways that I think it can work out, let me take a stab at the probabilities. And once you do that, now, as you have one of the particular types of futures turn out, you don't get overly attached to it. Instead, you use it as a way to tweak, right? As opposed to some really big signal to create a huge shift in whatever your underlying beliefs are.
Well, and one of the focuses of the book is about surrounding yourself with a good group of people who, you know, aren't yes men. I mean, so again, it's
kind
of like
a
business situation, but also in your personal life, you want people who give you real feedback or meaningful feedback, heterodox feedback. One of the things that you talk about that I thought was really interesting is the difference between exploratory thought and confirmatory thought.
I highly recommend people go look at Phil Tellock's work, and this is really where a lot of this is coming from. And he talks about these two styles of thoughts that you can get out of groups. So I think that we generally think that group decision making is better than individual decision making.
But this is the wisdom of the crowd type of stuff.
Yeah, the wisdom
right?
of the crowd kind of thing. So just get a group together, make decisions together, you'll all be better off. And that's actually not true. It depends on something about the group, and it's exactly what you just said. Does the group have a confirmatory thinking style or an exploratory thinking style? So a confirmatory thinking style is that we're all affirming each other's beliefs, right? That's sort of what we generally think of as an echo chamber. And by the way, it's where we like to be. Hmm. So the problem is that groups tend to drift off into this confirmatory style. What we'd really like to promote is an exploratory style. So we can think of the difference between the group trying to be right versus the group trying to be accurate. A group that's goal is to be right, this is going to be one with a confirmatory style, is their goal is to affirm that the beliefs that they have are right. That's the goal. In other words, whatever I believed before, I would like to know that that was the right thing to believe. A group whose goal is accuracy is actually going to have a very different goal in mind, which is it's not about making sure that my priors, that whatever I believed before is right, but making sure that the things that I believe are as good a representation of the objective truth as possible. So it sounds a little like, well, what's the difference between right and accurate? But it's a really, really deep distinction. And once you have a group who's committed to accuracy, now you naturally are going to develop an exploratory thought style. Because in order to have accurate beliefs, you have to be hungry for information. And what kind of information do you have to be particularly hungry for? Information that dissents with the prevailing view in the group.
Well, you know, that's an uncomfortable process because
we
know
process.
The answers and we just yes. want to do the math to get to show we're right. But on an individual level, how do you build up the resiliency to put yourself out there to say, okay, this is what I think is true, or this is what I want to be true, but then make sure that you're actually going through
the process to find out whether or not it really is true.
Being wrong is painful, right? I mean, our natural tendency as human beings is this tendency toward right versus accurate, mm-hmm. right? And we've made that distinction. So we like to think that our beliefs are true. We like to think mm-hmm. that good things that happen are to our credit and bad things that happen aren't our fault. And, you know, that we're intelligent and smart and well-informed individuals. And if you tell me something that completely disagrees with me, that our natural instinct is to feel threatened by that and to feel challenged by it. So I'll tend to try to swat it away. And the reason for that really comes back to, something Kahneman really, I think, said very well in Thinking Fast and Slow, which is that we want the narrative of our lives to be positive. As we think back on it, we want this positive narrative. And so sort of being right fits into that, you know, oh, I did a really good job, or that thing wasn't my fault. That all helps that narrative along. So the question is, how do you get that narrative to come together to maintain that positive narrative, but have it come together with this more exploratory style, this better focus on your beliefs being accurate, you know, in the objective sense. And it's through the group, right? So you go find some people who are committed to the same mission. And now, just like, you know, we've all heard about Pavlov and the bell, right? Like he rings the bell and the dogs are salivating and they're getting this reward that goes along with it, or a rat in a Skinner box. You know, he finishes the maze and mm-hmm. you give him a pellet and yay, the rat is happy. That the group can act to reinforce this exploratory style through two mechanisms. One is not to reward the more confirmatory style of thinking and to give you all of that really wonderful social approval from the exploratory mm-hmm. style of thinking. So the best example I can give you of this is a conversation that I had with Eric Seidel that has stuck with me. This was like super early in my career. I remember going up to Eric, who is one of the greatest players ever. I think that his total tournament earnings are something like $38 million-ish. Mm-hmm. Yeah, ballpark.
Right.
This is a really great player. So I went up to him and I was like, oh, I can't believe this. I got so unlucky. This guy played so bad and I played so much better than he did and blah, blah, blah. And it was, you know, moan. And I have never had such a blunt and bad reaction to something I have said to him. And this is someone I admired. I really wanted to be his peer. And what he said to me was, why are you telling me this story? Like, if it was just bad luck, like, literally, there's nothing to, you know, be learned from it. And by the way, I've lost a lot of hands too. And I've heard a lot of what we call bad beat stories. That's what I was telling him. I've heard so many bad beat stories. And honestly, I just don't care. Now, if you have a question about the hand, if you want to talk about strategy, if you're looking for my opinion on how you could have done better, be my guest. So I think that that statement from him sums up really perfectly, how do you get this kind of thinking going? Well, I wanted his social approval. So now, as I go to interact with him in the future, what kinds of things am I going to want to be telling him? I'm going to want to tell him, hey, I think I made a mistake. Why? Because he's going to give me a pellet for that, in the form of engagement, in the form of saying, wow, that's really great that you admitted that. I think that's amazing. Here's my perspective. And as I'm open-minded to his perspective, as I'm not swatting that away, he's giving me all of this reinforcement for that. What is he not reinforcing? Confirmatory style thought. And so now it's like you get to have your cake and eat it too, right? You get to be an exploratory thinker, but also still feel really good about yourself. Also feel like you have a positive narrative because you've changed the way that I like to put it, maybe because I'm a poker player, is you've changed the definition of what it means to win.
Is there a politics or an ideology embedded in the way you're talking about stuff? Because one of the things in contemporary America now, we talk a lot about echo chambers, and that, you know, partly, and it's good overall, but, you know, people can retreat to vast, endless storehouses of people who will confirm everything that you already believe, whether it's MSNBC or Fox News or, you know, the New York Times versus the Washington Times or something like that. And what you're talking about, it strikes me as very much of a kind of enlightenment view of that the truth, you know, we're never going to get there. So in a way, it's kind of a postmodern enlightenment. We're never going to know all the facts. We're never going to know everything, but we can approximate it by, you know, swearing allegiance to finding out what is true rather than what is convenient. And it sounded a lot to me in reading your book, some of it like Friedrich Hayek's thought, which really, and Karl Popper, emphasizing the limits of knowledge, and then how do you get a little bit smarter? And how are you disinterested so that you are actually, you know, moving forward and getting closer to truth or progress. Is that, am I off there, or do you have an ideology or a politics behind all of this?
I would say that for me, it's more the politics of constructive dissent. So take your choice. But what I think is that these echo chambers that we get, whether it's the echo chamber of, Democrats or the echo chamber of Republicans, you know, where it's all about, yes, 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 we're right, and the other side is bad. I don't think it's good for our society. I don't think it's good for our politics, for sure. I don't think it bodes well for the State of the Union. So if I think that regardless of whether you lean Democrat, you lean Republican, you lean classic liberal, whatever it might be, whatever your party identity is, let's have it not be the overriding identity so that you're willing to override your principles, override the fact of the matter, close your mind off to what the other side has to say. I kind of go back to, I go back to John Stuart Mill a lot on this.
Yeah, so, who is shot through the book.
He
really
is shot through the book because
yeah.
I would like everybody to read On Liberty, please. There you go. Please, everybody, go read that book. Read it before mine. or after, I guess. I should say read it after mine.
You know what? Buy them together.
Right. So here's the thing. When we've descended into an echo chamber of only listening to the opinions that affirm us, because we are so sure that we are right, what happens in that situation is that whatever your truth is has atrophied. Like, even if the even if that is actually the objective truth, your inability to be able to defend it against somebody who has a rational and I'm not talking about people who are just like yelling, you're dumb, right? But people who have a rational, reasonable explanation for why they hold an opposing viewpoint, you need to be able to debate that effectively. I think so. And this is John Stuart Mill says it, even if something is 100% true, you better be able to defend that against somebody who believes something differently. So, for example, I happen to believe the earth is round. But if I can't debate that effectively against a flat earther, it's somewhat meaningless that I believe that the earth is round. And when we descend into these political echo chambers, I think that we're descending into that problem. Sure, okay, the earth is round, but you can no longer defend it against the flat earther. So what does it mean that you believe that anymore? I think it completely loses its meaning. And I would argue that one of the things that happens when you force yourself to be able to defend it against the rational actors who hold different opinions is that you very often find out that your belief needs a little bit of calibration. And that's good for all of us, right? I mean, when I say, oh, you disagree with me, if my identity is no longer about being right, but it's about being someone who's searching for the most accurate objective truth of the matter, because you disagree with me, I no longer view you as an enemy. I view you as someone who can really help me.
Right.
Even though we disagree, you can now be really helpful, either because you moderate my opinion or because you make me better at understanding why I have that opinion in the first place. And either of those is good.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Annie Duke. She's the author, most recently, of Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.